the 26th study of the Apocalypse, held at the Enfield Ecclesial Hall on the 24th of August 1976. Brother John Knowles speaking to the subject, the position of the angel and how it is acquired. And the reading chosen is Deuteronomy chapter 33, verses 1 to 5 and verses 26 to 29.
And after that we will approach our Heavenly Father to pray. Number 8. Welcome you all here tonight from our own ecclesia and from other places, and especially also Brother and Sister Hall from the Victorian Ecclesia. The reading tonight will be Deuteronomy chapter 33 from verses 1 to 5 and from 26 to the end of the chapter, and the reading will be by Brother Robert Henderson.
Reading together Deuteronomy chapter 33, verses 1 to 5. And this is the blessing wherewith Moses, the man of God, blessed the children of Israel before his death. And he said, Yahweh came from Sinai and rose up from Seir unto them. He shined forth from Mount Paran, and he came with 10,000s of saints. From his right hand went a fiery law for them. Yea, he loved the people. All his saints are in thy hand, and they sat down at thy feet. Every one shall receive of thy words. Moses commanded us a law, even the inheritance of the congregation of Jacob. And he was king in Jeshurun, when the heads of the people and the tribes of Israel were gathered together. Reading verse Deuteronomy 33:26-29. There is none like unto the God of Jeshurun, who rideth upon the heaven in thy help, and in his excellency on the sky. The eternal God is thy refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. He shall thrust out the enemy from before thee, and shall say, Destroy them. Israel then shall dwell in safety alone. The fountain of Jacob shall be upon a land of corn and wine. Also his heavens shall drop down dew. Happy art thou, O Israel, who is like unto thee, O people saved by Yahweh, the shield of thy help, and who is the sword of thy excellency. And thine enemies shall be found liars unto thee, and thou shalt tread upon their high places.
The study will be tonight from Eureka 548, under the title Position of the Angel and How It Is Acquired, and Brother John Norse will lead the class now.
Dear class members, well, we're continuing our study from Revelation chapter 10 by looking at that section in Eureka volume 2 entitled The Position of the Angel and How It Is Acquired. Why are we doing this? Well, because in Revelation chapter 10, John says, I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head. And so it is this rainbowed angel that we're looking at in quite some detail. In other words, what Brother Thomas is doing in this section of Eureka is amplifying from other parts of the scripture some of the details which are only given in a very condensed form here in Revelation chapter 10. And so, as our chairman said, we have considered last time from page 544, and we did about four pages last time, and we're going to take over from where we left off then. I'm not going to do any growling tonight or anything like that. I feel very happy because I had a lot of comments from people who've been reading this section, and so it doesn't hurt to give a word of praise now and again. And I hope that most of you were able to read it, and I know those who did said they got a lot out of it and they thoroughly enjoyed it, so that's very good. In fact, many said they didn't find it quite as difficult as they expected. Well, perhaps that's good too, but perhaps, as I pointed out kindly to some of them, perhaps you didn't read it quite as slowly as you might have, because perhaps you've missed a lot of details. But anyway, that's why you come to the class, isn't it? To see if between us we can pick up all of the details. And this evening we're going to spend quite a bit of time just on the first few paragraphs that we're going to be looking at. Well, what did we see last time, for the sake of those who perhaps weren't here? Brother Thomas wanted to show us how the angel was going to acquire this position of one foot on the sea and one foot on the earth. This is the position in which he is seen in Revelation chapter 10. Now, in this section in Eureka, he is going to show to us how he gets into that position. The one foot on the sea and the one foot on the earth is the ultimate position where he stands ready to judge the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth. In other words, these are going to be the judgments which will commence with Armageddon and flow on afterwards. But what Brother Thomas asks is, what does he do before he gets into that position? How does he acquire this particular position? And we looked essentially at three passages of scripture, didn't we? It was Deuteronomy chapter 33, Psalm 68, and Habakkuk chapter 3. These were three passages which showed to us that his work was going to commence in the area of Sinai. You'll also be very pleased to know that those two slides that I put up last time, which I think are very good ones, and I think you all found them very helpful, are going to be eventually printed. We hope to print them in colour, at least Maynard hopes to print them in colour, I should say. Just to give you some idea of what you may be getting soon, you've been able to reproduce a few in black and white like that, and they're very, very useful because they do show us a particularly good view of the area of Mount Sinai and of the whole of the Sinai Peninsula. But if we can get them in colour, then it also distinguishes what the different rock formations are. For example, the granite of down here and the limestone of further up and the areas where there is vegetation and so forth. The beauty of this was too that this was taken from a book about 100 years old, so that the names of the places on here are the same as we've got in Eureka. So we hope sometime in the near future to have those out for you. So those of you who are worrying about trying to copy those two slides last week, last fortnight, don't worry unduly, because we'll get these printed. printed in due course. So we looked in detail at this area of Sinai. But we've come down now to what is in the black edition, the first paragraph on page 548. We're going to read this paragraph and we're going to spend a bit of time looking at it. He says, the reader is requested. Anyone who's got the red edition doesn't know where we are? 174 in the red edition, okay. And it starts with the words, the reader is requested to note that when Moses delivered his prophetic blessing upon the tribes of Israel, he was in the plains of Moab and soon about to leave them. He was in the plains of Moab. I guess in your preparation you all looked up a map to find out where the plains of Moab were, but in case you've just forgotten, the plain of Moab, you see, is getting well up towards the land itself. Styled on this particular one, the land of Moab, up here on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. And there's the land of Moab. So as the doctor rightly says, when Moses spoke those words, he was in the plains of Moab and soon about to leave them. This was about 100 miles north of Mount Paran. So here's the area of Paran down here. So he said that's about 100 miles north of the area of Paran. When Israel heard the blessing, would they not desire to know, in view of Moses' speedy death, where help was to come from to establish the blessing? In reply to this, the answer is found in the oracle, and this is the section we read this evening from Deuteronomy 33. There is none like the ale of Yeshurun, riding heavens in thy help, and clouds in his potence. The Elohim of olden time, a refuge, and underneath the arms of Olam. And he shall thrust out the enemy from before thee, and shall command to destroy. Israel shall then dwell in safety alone, a people saved by Yahweh, the shield of thy help, and the sword of thy excellency. And thine enemies shall be found liars unto thee, and thou shalt tread upon their high places. Now, that is a translation, Brother Thomas's own translation, from Deuteronomy chapter 33 and verses 26 and 27. He's going to go on in just a moment and take us back to the early verses of Deuteronomy 33. So seeing this is the case, let's just for a minute or two, and I don't mean any longer than that either, just see what Deuteronomy 33 is all about, so we can see the context in which he is quoting this. Deuteronomy 32 is a chapter which is styled the Song of Moses. Deuteronomy 32 starts off in the last verse of chapter 31 by saying, Moses spake in the ears of the congregation of Israel the words of this song until they were ended. Give ear, O ye heavens, and I will speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. And he goes on to speak in prophetic, poetic language about the future of Israel. Then when he comes to chapter 33, he pronounces the blessings upon the tribes. Now, we didn't read the actual blessings upon the tribes. We read the introduction to the blessings, and we read the conclusion to the blessings. So apart from the blessings which intervene, going from Deuteronomy 33, verse 6, through to about verse 25, they are the more detailed descriptions of what would happen to the individual tribes. We've got the general picture then in that section which we've read. So the lead up to the blessings in verses 1 to 5 and the conclusion to them in verses 26 to 29. Now he quotes from the conclusion first of all and then goes back to the introduction. Perhaps if I was doing it, I would have done it the other way around. But I won't, because we're reading Eureka and we'll do it the way the doctor has. Now, what's he doing? He's quoting Deuteronomy 33, verse 26 and verse 27. When we look at this in the Authorised Version, we read there, there is none like unto the God of Jeshurun, who rideth upon the heaven in thy help, and in his excellency on the sky. Brother Thomas says, there is none like the ale of Jeshurun, riding heavens in thy help, and clouds in his potence. Now what does he change? He changes God to ale. Well, that's not exactly a change. That's just a helpful addition by using the actual Hebrew word. He changes sky to clouds, And he uses the word potence for excellency, although I think in looking it up, the word excellency is quite accurate, really. So we want to have a look at what these verses tell us. Let's take verse 26, first of all. Now, do you know what Jeshurun means? Did you just read it through and say, yes, that was an interesting quote, and wonder what Jeshurun was, or did you look it up? See, this is one of the important things. I suppose if I'd have not flashed that up quite so quickly, I could have asked who knew what it was, but that's not the point. I was going to be kindly disposed towards you this evening and not do that sort of thing. So ask yourself, did I know what Jeshurun meant, or didn't I? If I didn't, why didn't I look it up? And the answer was, well, I didn't know where to look it up. Of course you knew where to look it up, because we went through that a couple of classes ago. It's in the concordance, isn't it? So our first note here is in relation to this term, the ale of Jeshurun. Now what does it mean to us? Well, if you look up a concordance, like Strong's, for example, you'll get exactly what I've got up there. Strong's can give you all of that. Now, the word Jeshurun, or it can be Jeshurun, because the J and the Y are really the same sort of thing. The word Jeshurun comes from the root Yasha, and it means upright. Means upright. It occurs only here, that is in this passage, Deuteronomy 33, verse 26, and in chapter 32, verse 15, in chapter 33, verse 5, and over in Isaiah 44, verse 2. So whilst the word Yasha itself occurs in quite a number of places, that's the root from which it comes, this word Jeshurun, meaning the upright ones, or upright one, occurs only four times. That is, in Isaiah 32, verse 15, Isaiah 33, verses 5 and 26, and Isaiah 44, verse 2. So three quarters of them occur in this particular section of the scriptures. Now, why does this particular term occur here? And it's obviously applied to Israel. Well, we note that the word Yasha itself occurs in Isaiah 32 and verse 4. Let's go back to Isaiah 32, which, as I mentioned earlier, was the song preceding the blessings. We've read verse 1, let's read verse 2. Isaiah 32, verse 2. My doctrine shall drop as the rain, my speech shall distill as the dew, as the small rain upon the tender herb, and as the showers upon the grass, because I will publish the name of Yahweh, ascribe ye greatness unto our Elohim. He is the rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are judgment, an ale of truth, and without iniquity, just and Yasha is he. Just and Yasha. The word translated right there is this word Yasha. So this is the root from which it comes. Oh, what did I say? Isaiah 32. Oh, it's up there, isn't it? Deuteronomy 32. Well, I suppose it doesn't even say Deuteronomy there, does it? Oh, well, it was Deuteronomy 32. We've all got that now. You rub that bit out on the tapes. Right, it was Deuteronomy 32. If I say any other things like that tonight, let me know. I just sort of feel I might be going to. Yeah, I do. So if I do, you let me know. Okay, so notice verse 4 then of Deuteronomy 32. The word right is the word Yasha. So it's putting this before us then as the characteristic of God himself in regard to Israel. And when we come down then to verse 15, we read, but Jeshurun waxed fat and kicked. Now here is almost a contradiction in terms. God was right. God was the basis of all uprightness. Now he calls Israel by this name Jeshurun, which is, now you are the upright ones. But although I've called you to be the upright ones, what have you done? You've waxed fat and you've kicked. You are waxen fat, you are grown thick, you are covered with fatness. Then he forsook Eloah, which made him, and lightly esteemed the rock of his salvation. So the term is used of Israel, who were called to be the upright ones. They were called to follow the characteristics of their creator, of the Eloah who made them, but they weren't. They were just fat and lazy. And so when we come on then into chapter 33, we read in verse 5, concerning Yahweh, that he was king in Yeshurun. He was the king of these upright ones when the heads of the people and the tribes of Israel were gathered together. And then, of course, we come to this one now in chapter 33 and verse 26. There is none like unto the ale of Yeshurun. So this is the expression then that is used to introduce the way in which God is going to manifest his glory in the earth as the power goes forth from Sinai. So he says it's going to be the ale of Yeshurun, the strength of these upright ones, who is going to ride upon the heaven in his help, and in his he is going to ride upon the heaven in thy help, and in his excellency on the sky. So here is the idea. He is the strength of the upright ones. Israel at this time were not the upright ones. They were called to be, but they were not. And so the term is used here prophetically of what the people of God will be in the time to come. So there is the term Yeshurun. It means the upright ones. Now we come to the next word, which is the word rideth. This is also quite significant. The word rideth is the Hebrew word rakav. You may have come across this word before. When we've done a study of the cherubim, we usually say that the word cherub comes from the root rakav, which means to ride. So we've noted up there that the Hebrew word rakav, from which is derived the word cherub. So if the word rakav means to ride, the word cherub means that which is ridden. And in general terms it could be described, say, as a chariot, that in which Yahweh will manifest his glory, the means of manifesting the glory, the conveyance in which the glory will be transported. Now we've noted some important references or some important occurrences of this word. Let's look at them briefly, but we're going to be coming across these quite a bit in the succeeding study. In Psalm 68, for example, and verse 4. Psalm 68 and verse 4. Sing unto Elohim, sing praises to his name, extol him that rideth upon the heavens by his name Yah, and rejoice before him. Now this expression, riding upon the heavens, doesn't occur a lot in the scripture, but here it is in Deuteronomy 33, here it is in Psalm 68. You know, these are the passages we've been looking at. He rides upon the heavens. Likewise in verse 33 of the psalm, to him that rideth upon the heavens of heavens, which were of old, lo, he doth send out his voice, and that a mighty voice. And verse 34, by implication, ascribe ye strength unto Elohim, his excellency is over Israel, and his strength is in the clouds. Whilst the word rideth doesn't occur there, the theme follows on and it makes reference to the clouds. Another one is Isaiah 19 verse 1, which those who've read ahead will recall as being quoted quite copiously in succeeding pages. Isaiah 19 verse 1, the burden of Egypt. Behold, Yahweh rideth upon a swift cloud, and shall come into Egypt, and the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. So Psalm 68 speaks of him as riding upon the heavens. Isaiah 19 speaks of him as riding upon a swift cloud. Both terms are found in Deuteronomy 33. Habakkuk chapter 3 verse 8, which of course is the third of those three references we looked at last time. And here in Habakkuk 3 verse 8 we've got a similar reference to this riding. Habakkuk chapter 3 and verse 8. Was Yahweh displeased against the rivers? Was thine anger against the rivers? Was thy wrath against the sea, that thou didst ride upon thy horses and thy chariots of salvation? So here we've got the idea of riding upon horses and the chariots of salvation. This is the cherubim. And so what we've got then in Deuteronomy chapter 33 is a picture of the cherubim. We've got this picture then of the strength of the upright ones, who is going to manifest himself by riding upon the heaven in thy help, and in his excellency on the sky, or on the clouds. I've mentioned up there on the screen that the same ideas are also expressed in Psalm 18 verse 10 and Psalm 104 verse 3, and whilst the word Rachab itself does not occur there, the same ideas are expressed. Now let's take the final word that we want to look at in this verse, and that is the word sky. We note that the word sky is the Hebrew word S-H-A-C-H-A-Q, which actually literally means a powder. It means a powder as something which has been beaten small. Hence, we get the idea by analogy, a thin vapour, or of course the clouds. So the word sky there is this word which is it's something beaten small, and of course you can see the idea that it's speaking of the very fine droplets of water in the form of vapour which form clouds. It doesn't mean to say every time you come across the word shakak it means clouds. It does mean a very small beaten up thing. For example, Isaiah 40 speaks about weighing up weighing up the earth, and it's like the dust of the balance. The word dust there is the same word. So what we've done then is we've confirmed the translation of Brother Thomas, and we found some rather interesting features. Now, what are the interesting features? Well, the first one is that he uses the term the ale of the upright ones. He speaks about him riding upon the heavens in thy help, and in his majesty or his excellency on the clouds. Now, I don't want to extend it much more at this stage, because we're going to extend it automatically as we go along. But I did want to just bring out those few technical points there. And in regard to verse 27 as well, we've got two terms here in verse 27 which we should note. We read, the eternal God is thy refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. Now, normally the word eternal and the word everlasting are the same word, but they are not here. The word eternal, which we find in this place, is really the word which means of olden time. It literally means, where it's got the eternal God, it is literally the Elohim of olden times. The word eternal there is actually the Hebrew word kedem. And I haven't told you what it means, I didn't go into all the details, but it's rather an interesting word because it means to be in front of. And you can either be in front of something in respect of time or place. If ever it's used in respect of place, it's usually translated by the word east, which is an interesting little diversion which we won't go into. For example, we read that God planted a garden eastward in Eden. The word east there is this word kedem. And the word east is this word kedem because as far as place is concerned, the Hebrews spoke of the east as being in front of them. In other words, they always faced east. The tabernacle always faced east. The sun rose in the east. Therefore, east was in front of them. So to be in front of, in respect of place, usually meant to be looking in an easterly direction, but to be in front of, in respect of time, meant something that had gone before. So the word kedem then means of old if used in respect of time. My note says here, the word eternal, Hebrew kedem, means the front, in brackets of place, that is the east, or time, that is antiquity. This is the only place where it has been translated as eternal, the only place in the Bible. So it's not talking about the eternal God in that sense, but it's talking about the Elohim of olden times. And then when it speaks about the everlasting arms, well, the word everlasting there is the word olam, which is normally translated as eternal or of the age or something similar to that. It is the equivalent to the Greek word aeon. Now, what I've done then is down the bottom of the page, I've put a translation which I think brings out the significance of this. It's my own collation. It's not my own translation, but it's a combination of the Doctor's translation and Rotherham's, checking up on some of the words, and I haven't accepted either of them in entirety, but I think it's given to me the idea a little better than perhaps any other independent translation. Let's see what this says. This is Deuteronomy 33, verses 26 and 27, according to my rendering. There is none like the ale of Yeshurun, riding upon the heavens to thy help, and for his own majesty upon the clouds. Above is the Elohim of olden time, and beneath are the arms of the Olam. And he shall thrust out the enemies from before thee, and shall command, destroy. That follows fairly closely Rotherham's translation, with one or two of Brother Thomas's ideas put in. Now, can we see what's being suggested here then? It speaks about this great one called the power of the upright ones. There is none like the ale or the power of Yeshurun. And he's going to ride upon the heavens to thy help, Israel, and for his own majesty upon the clouds. Now he says, above is the Elohim of olden time. The one riding upon the cloud is not so much the ale himself, as it is the Elohim of olden times, because ale manifested himself through the Elohim. The ale of Yeshurun, the power of the upright ones, has manifested himself through the mighty ones of olden times. So as he rides upon the clouds, above we have the Elohim of olden time. And beneath? Well, beneath we have the everlasting arms, the arms of the Olam, the arms which are going to work on behalf of Israel. And so we've got, in a very figurative sense, this multitude of mighty ones who are manifesting the power of the ale of Yeshurun, floating in on a cloud, in figurative language. And as they float over the Sinai Peninsula on the cloud, underneath are the arms, which are going to be there to help Israel. He's going to ride upon the heaven in thy help, and his excellency on the sky. And so it is the Elohim of olden time that is riding this, and beneath are the arms of the Olam. But it's not going to be to the help of Israel first of all. Those arms, first of all, have to manifest judgment. And so he shall thrust out the enemies from before thee, and shall command, destroy. Now this is to be the work of that rainbowed angel. The angel of the rainbow of Revelation chapter 10 is here described in these two very beautiful verses from Deuteronomy 33, verses 26 and 27. Now we can go back then to Eureka, the next paragraph, where Brother Thomas is now going to comment upon this and take us a step further. But those satisfied that ale, see the reference to the ale of Yeshurun, but those satisfied that ale, or the omnipotence that had helped them through the Elohim hitherto, was their only help, see the point we're making? They're satisfied that ale, that's that one there, who had helped them in times past through the Elohim, you know, the Elohim of olden times. But those satisfied that ale, the power, or the omnipotence that had helped them through the Elohim hitherto, was their only help, yet they were accustomed to the manifestation of divine power in specially appointed places. Where then were they to look for him in his coming to help? Where would he rise up unto them when he should appear to destroy their enemies and cause them to dwell in safety alone? He's quoting there from some of these latter verses of Deuteronomy 33. So he says, where's it all going to happen? The answer to this, in Deuteronomy 33 verse 2, presupposes the accomplishment of the enterprise. Because although it is yet in the future, it is as certain to come to pass as if it had already been fulfilled. For this reason, the future event is foretold in terms of the past. We've already commented on this, haven't we, in the last study. Although it's in past tense, it is obviously future. And so now he quotes from Deuteronomy 33, verse 2. Yahweh came in from Sinai and rose up from Seir unto them. He caused to shine forth from Mount Paran, and he came with 10,000 of the holy, from his right hand a fiery mandate for them. So he's now going to answer the question, how is he going to get there? By going back and quoting these early verses of Deuteronomy 33. Yea, he loved the peoples, all his saints are in thy hand. Now, says Brother Thomas, Moses speaks in this of an entrance from Sinai, a coming into the land from Sinai by way of Seir and Paran, not of a coming to Sinai. Now, he makes some comments here about the various words. Let's have a look at Deuteronomy 33, verse 2. The word came occurs twice in this particular verse. Now, I haven't got a transparency on this, so you'll have to copy it down just from what I say. The word came occurs twice in Deuteronomy 33, verse 2, but they're two different words, and they're important to the understanding of this progression from Sinai to Zion. Yahweh came from Sinai is the first occurrence of the word. Now, that word came there is the common word translated come or go, for that matter. It's the Hebrew word bo. Those of you who can remember the olden times when we did the study of Daniel will remember this was the first study we did in the early verses of chapter 1, where it read that in the third year of Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came unto Jerusalem. And the word came there was the word bo. And we said, well, there was a problem there. How could he come in the third year when Jeremiah says that he wasn't king until the fourth year? And a few things like this. And we found out that the word came can also be translated to go. For example, Jonah caught a ship going to Tarshish, and the word is bo. So this Hebrew word bo can either mean to come or to go, depending entirely on the context. And I'm going to suggest, and the rest of the verse will confirm this, that really where it says Yahweh came from Sinai, it would be better to render that as he set out from Sinai. Brother Thomas says something about him coming in from Sinai. Yes, well, it can mean that too, but I don't think that quite gives the idea of it. I think if we see that as a setting out, which is what the word bow can mean. You see, it just depends on where you're standing. If you're standing at that end and you see the person coming, or if you're standing at that person and see them going, doesn't matter, they're still going in the same direction. But I think you'll find it flows a little bit better, as I'll demonstrate in just a moment, if you understand that word bow there in the sense of setting out rather than of coming. It means, in other words, really to depart. And of course, if you're at this end waiting for the person, you see them as coming. If you're that end seeing them going, well, they're still departing, aren't they? So Yahweh then departed or set out from Sinai. Or if you like to stand up in Moab, you can see him coming in from Sinai. Doesn't matter. The other word came is the word he came with 10,000s of saints. And this is the Hebrew word athar, A-T-H-A-H. Brother Thomas has it at the bottom of page 548 as A-H-T-H-A-H. There's no real difference there. It's just trying to transliterate the Hebrew words and letters into English. And it really means to arrive. It has been translated as to arrive. Brother Thomas says that he just makes it as came. Well, that's all right, it still means came, but I'm being just a little bit more technical than the doctor in this place. I can't very often say that, but I am in this case. So we've got that then. The word first word came is the word bow, which means to come or to go, but specifically in this case to set out. The second word came, he came with 10,000s of saints, is the Hebrew word athar, and it means to arrive. And the other word which we must look at, which Brother Thomas also comments on here, and I go right along with him this time, no diversions or anything like that. This word rose up. Brother Thomas said that the word rose up signifies, right at the bottom of the page, signifies to rise up as the sun. And I thought, oh, well, you know, that sounds very good. I wonder if it's as good as it sounds. So I looked it up, checked it up, and yes, that is correct. It means to rise up as the sun, to irradiate. And it is used of the rising of the sun. That is the particular word. Now, here's the beauty of the thing. Let's now present a translation of that verse. I can read it out to you, but I've got it on a transparency somewhere, I'm sure. Now, this is what I've called a literal translation. Once again, I can't quote the authority because it's a combination of Brother Thomas's translation, Rotherham's, and my own, with just a glance at the Jerusalem Bible too. I did look at all the others, but they are the only ones that bore any resemblance to what we are looking for as far as the significance here is concerned. Now, here is a literal translation which now gives to us the picture of what we're looking for. Yahweh set forth from Sinai. He dawned or arose as the sun out of Seir upon them, and he shone forth out of Mount Paran. See the progression. He set forth from Sinai, he rose up as the sun from Seir, and he shone forth in all the brilliance of the sun from Mount Paran. Yea, he arrived with 10,000s of the holy. From his right hand a fiery mandate for them. So this then is in answer to the question, where is this Ale of Yeshurun going to come from? How is he going to ride upon the heaven in his help and in his excellency on the sky? Well, this is how he's going to do it. He's going to set out from Sinai, he's going to arise as a sun from Seir, and he's going to shine forth in all his brilliance out of Mount Paran, and he's going to arrive with 10,000 of the holy, from his right hand a fiery mandate for them. So the same ideas of judgment. Going back then to Eureka, Brother Thomas makes this comment from where we left off. Around about six lines from the bottom of page 548. Moses speaks in this of an entrance from Sinai, a coming into the land from Sinai by way of Seir and Paran, not of a coming to Sinai. The word I have rendered came in or entered, bar, I said it's both, doesn't matter, from Sinai, is different from came with 10,000s, which is Asar. Asar might be better. The word Zarak, rose up, signifies to rise up as the sun. Hence the sun rising in Seir and the shining forth from Mount Paran. Now to summarise it, Brother Thomas's final comment here in this paragraph is a beautiful summary. This Mosaic vision is unquestionably identical with John's. The Ale of Yeshurun riding heavens and clouds with a mandate of destruction in his right hand is no other than the rainbowed angel with the little scroll of fiery judgments in his hand, which when executed result in the deliverance of Israel and the overthrow of all their enemies. So it was all there in Revelation 10 after all. That angel with the rainbow around his head and that little scroll in his hand contains in that little scroll all of the things that we've just been reading about here in Deuteronomy 33, but also described in Psalm 68, Isaiah 19, Habakkuk chapter 3 and all of those other places. So I thought those two paragraphs were important, and I did envisage taking about this much time on them because there's quite a lot in there. Now, the allusions to this go right through these passages. You just glance over to Habakkuk 3, for example, and see how it's the same theme there. In Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 2, O Yahweh, I have heard thy speech and was afraid. O Yahweh, revive thy work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years make known, in wrath remember mercy. Eloah came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran, Selah. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise, and his brightness was as the light. He had horns coming out of his hand, and there was the hiding of his power. Now see how this is an accumulation of all those terms in Deuteronomy 33. Even that expression, horns coming out of his hand, is rather interesting, because that expression, horns coming out of his hand, is literally rays of light or pencils of light. And that's exactly what Deuteronomy 33 says, that he's going to dawn out of Seir and shine forth out of Paran. Same thing as he's saying here. His brightness was as the light, and he had rays of light coming out of his hand. You know, the hand is on the end of the arm, and the arm was what was beneath, wasn't it? In Deuteronomy 33, the Elohim were above, and the arms, the everlasting arms, were beneath. Before him went the pestilence, and burning coals went forth at his feet. He stood and measured the earth. He beheld and drove asunder the nations, and the everlasting mountains were scattered. The perpetual hills did bow. His ways are everlasting. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble, all the area of Sinai. Was Yahweh displeased against the rivers? Was thine anger against the rivers? Was thy wrath against the sea, that thou didst ride upon thy horses, and thy chariots of salvation? Thy bow was made quite naked, according to the oaths of the tribes, even thy word. I won't say any more about Habakkuk 3, because that will come again in due course. Right, is there anything out of those two particular paragraphs that anyone would like to comment on? And it's almost time for turning over the C90s. Who would like to? Anything out of those two paragraphs? Arthur? Yes, Arthur wants to know what Arthur means. Now, what did I say about it? I gave it... Just a minute, I'll look it up. The word came